Laudato Jesus Christus. This is the English program of Vatican Radio.
Hello and welcome to this edition of our English feature program. I'm Philippa Hitchin. Coming up today, the northern English city of Liverpool becomes a pioneer in a project for the new evangelization of Europe. Hear from the city's Archbishop Patrick Kelly. And the new nation of South Sudan celebrates independence. Hear personal testimony from a priest who was jailed in Juba, but is now working to promote peace and reconciliation between North and South. The Archbishop of Liverpool, Patrick Kelly, was amongst a dozen leaders of major European dioceses who attended a summit meeting at the recently established Pontifical Council for New Evangelization here in the Vatican on Monday. The cardinals and bishops from Barcelona, Budapest, Brussels, Cologne, Dublin, Lisbon, Liverpool, Paris, Turin, Warsaw and Vienna were called in to share ideas with the council's president, Archbishop Rino Fisichella, for a pilot project aimed at revitalizing the church in their cities. With its past history as a centre of the slave trade, its difficult journey from mass immigration to a model of ecumenical cooperation, and its futuristic metropolitan cathedral, the northern English city of Liverpool has a rich Catholic tradition to draw on for this task, as I found out when Archbishop Kelly came over to our studios at the end of the closed-door meeting.
I think it's first of all wise to remember this is the very early days of this new pontifical council, and it already has a charter given to it, but of course there's then to be a synod about the new evangelization next year. So these are preliminary first steps. And the gathering today was very interesting. When I first saw the list, I wondered, well, why am I on this list? Because it's an interesting group of dioceses from across Europe. And the purpose seemed to me this to try and see through ways in which some sort of pilot scheme could be done through these dioceses, very much cooperating with each other as a joint expression of working together on the evangelisation that's needed, recognising both we face similar challenges, but also very different ones from one city to another. So that's what today was all about.
So why Liverpool in particular, do you think?
Well, I don't know. Because in a quite serious level, this may be the point. As far as I could tell, by far, Liverpool is the smallest of the cities in terms of Catholics represented there today. For example, if you compared us with the numbers of Catholics in Lisbon, Barcelona, Paris, Dublin, we are very small indeed. And of course, as perhaps I've shared with the listeners in the past, the reality of still demographic decline is a very big factor of the life which we're having to live. The other thing might be because, and this may not have been conscious, but it seems to me that the economic crisis, which has got to be part of the context of anything we now do as church, it's something that hits Liverpool very sharply indeed, especially if we seriously take that part of the roots of the economic crisis, I believe, are the changed relationship between at least some cities in Europe and the whole world. It was an African bishop who, in 2008 in Liverpool, when the economic crisis began, said what is happening is the end of the slave trade. That all the wealth that came to, especially Western Europe, but not just there, from either Africa or South America, that is over. And we're having to think of ourselves in a very different way.
So you were looking very closely at economic issues, political, social issues, and the role of the church within
It was a very broad discussion, and it varied from place to place because, as I said, it is. I don't think any city is hit as hard as Liverpool is. And the example I gave demographically, there was a time between the main railway station and the river, which was barely half the territory of the city. There once were nearly a million people. Today, the whole city is 450,000. And I once had a conversation with the Archbishop of Detroit, and he said, I wanted to meet you because we are unique in the world, the two cities with the greatest demographic decline, which creates specific questions. And of course, it is a symbol, if you like, of the changed relationship of Europe with the rest of the world. The example I give on our waterfront, for which I'm grateful, there's a derelict tobacco warehouse, the largest there ever was in the world. And it's now derelict, but it stands there as a reminder of when, in the initial days, there was this dreadful triangle: slaves, Africa to the Americas, raw materials, Americas to Europe, finished products, Europe to Africa. And I'm glad it's there. It says, think about your past.
So a reminder of the past, but also looking to the future and how the church is coping with these vast demographic changes.
Well, for us, but I didn't hear it from anywhere else. I think it's quite, as far as I can tell, those bishops I spoke with, all their cities are still seeing an increase in the number of people who live in their cities. Some have the question of a growing number of people who are not Christian in their cities, but we are simply still in demographic decline. Not true across the whole of England, where I was bishop before, only 30 miles away in Manchester. That city is still growing, but has an increasing number of people, for example, who follow the Muslim religion. So diversity within 35 miles.
Difficult in a meeting like this to come up with any real guidelines,
absolutely,
any real ways forward.
But the point may be, I do think there is something very strong when precisely those with diverse experiences speak with some united vision as to where we want to go. And I think it's rooted in the model which St. Paul gives of the church as the body of Christ, where he dares to say the weakest members are indispensable. I think that's one of the most precious lines in the New Testament. In other words, the sign the church gives is not a sign which can only cope with those who are terribly strong in their faith and in their convictions. But part of the sign is our family includes the people hanging on by their fingertips. That's part of the sign we give. I was intrigued, I just noticed the Holy Father's words at the Angelus talking about the God who doesn't force us to love. He invites us. That's it.
If you're looking at ways to try and strengthen the church in these very uncertain situations, whatever they may be in these different contexts across the European continent, what kind of ways were you looking at, perhaps, in which the church can really be encouraged, supported, strengthened in its mission?
Two ways. First of all, we're already starting in the diocese a programme of trying once more, because others have tried, to take seriously the rite of infant baptism, which the new gift in that rite, which Pope Paul VI gave us. We did baptise babies before then, but we used a version of the adult rite. It was Paul VI who gave us the rite of infant baptism. And the significant difference was the whole focus is on the parents. And they are described as the first and prayed that they may be the best of teachers. We are just starting, and so far the signs are very good, of shifting the emphasis in the whole of the formation of children for celebrating sacraments from catechists who work with the children to catechists who work with the parents to enable the parents to work with the children. It's a long journey, but the first signs, we've only been seeking to do this for a few weeks, but where we've had little pilot projects, it has been very, very encouraging.
Supporting family life, in fact, as well as...
Exactly. And one of the things I've done when celebrating confirmation, or indeed whenever I've been present, for example, not at a First Communion Mass, because that would be rare, simply being a bishop, but where the First Communionists have come together, I invite the parents to renew their baptismal promises, not the children, and invite the parents to place their hand on the shoulder of their child. It is quite extraordinary. Very simple, very small, but you suddenly realise that whereas if the children do it, it's a video moment to video their children. When the parents do it, it becomes a very still moment and you suddenly feel a real engagement, and it's very good for a bishop to find nobody is looking at me. Their focus is genuinely parent to child, child to parent. And so it's small, but it does show that vision Paul VI gave us, we must work at it. And that's one small thing we're doing. And we had a launch week and 64 priests came. And the same day they were meeting, there were something like 200 teachers meeting to talk about the same thing. And over the course of the week, I think it was over 300 catechists. Now, we were quite staggered. In other words, it's as if people were saying, let's try. I think the other focus, because of the context and the example I gave, the cost of fuel for heating houses rising by 18% on the 1st of September. Every week, people who do the shopping remind me the price of food is inexorably rising. That is the context. Unemployment is growing. The resources for those in need are diminishing. I think the phrase we need above all, it's, I think, like the spirit of Pope Benedict, it's so wonderful on this. The spirit, I think, at this time is carry one another's burdens. If we show we are carrying one another's burdens, within, if you like, the Catholic family first, but then reaching out to others, I think that's the way the Lord gathered people around himself.
Liverpool has a particular tradition, doesn't it, in a sense of caring for those?
Well, it goes back, of course. One of the great, great men in that was Father James Nugent, who in the days of the vast number of immigrants from Ireland after the famine and the horrors of their pain, they came in their tens of thousands. He saw the need and established a response to a great variety of needs. And amazingly, on his death, by public subscription, not Catholic subscription, the statue was placed in his honour in the gardens at the town hall. And there it stands to this day. It's very special. And I think in the same spirit, what I think is a beautiful gift to people who come to the city, the statue, I think it was opened 2 years ago now, to Archbishop Warlock and Bishop David Shepherd, who in the city's darkest days in recent years accompanied the people of the city. And the artist has given us a challenge. It's if you like, it's on three circles. On one circle stands Archbishop Warlock, on the other, Bishop David Shepherd. The third one is empty. And the artist, Stephen Broadbent, says, each one of us has got to decide, will we stand on that third circle and continue their work or not? Without that being occupied, we're walking past. Quite a challenge.
Archbishop Warlock, of course, the former Catholic Archbishop, David Shepherd, the
Anglican Archbishop, yes.
A huge example of ecumenical cooperation.
Huge. And interesting, we had a wonderful visit from Cardinal Casper last year. Mainly a small thing, but we've one of the last steps in the beauty of our marvellous cathedral is the incorporation of eight pillars in glass outside. And the artist was a personal friend of Cardinal Casper. So we managed for the Cardinal to come to bless them. And it was Pentecost Sunday, the year when we have the two cathedrals walk, when we walk from one cathedral to the other along Hope Street. And the Cardinal said this is a model for many, because he found the fact it was an organised procession, but you could keep changing who you were walking with. And he said, this is so easy, and you're clearly so natural with each other that there's nobody's surprised it's happening. But similarly, a very personal one, but some time ago now, my driver died, a marvellous Catholic, and at his funeral, besides my homily, the Anglican bishop spoke. And nobody considered it as odd. It was just right. I think that was so important. Nobody said, oh, how amazing. They took it for granted, of course he would be there.
So great progress in ecumenical cooperation that continues the legacy, if you like, of Warlock and Shepherd.
And recently, I mean, it's rather curious, the city is deprived because I've had 3 months because of a new hip, and now Bishop James has had a bypass, so he's off for 3 months. So the city has to manage with one or the other, but it can't have both of us for a little while.
Liverpool then is clearly a model for perhaps ecumenical cooperation, and yet the challenges of a secular world remain very much at the forefront, don't they?
They do and they don't. But I think the reason is that this sort of hard and fast, like, confrontation has not been part of our story. As I say, going back to Father Nugent, he wasn't doing it over against the city. He was doing it with the city. That seemed to me very, very important. And that has not gone. And again, when we had that marvellous conference joining together the bishops of Africa and Europe, CECAM and CCE, it was perfectly natural for the Lord Mayor to give a civic reception. And it was genuinely natural. Of course, this matters to the city. So I think that the model may be that sort of cooperation, which we've, in a sense, got used to. But it's not an easy road. I mean, Archbishop Warlock often said, sometimes you find yourself having to walk with people with whom on many things you will disagree, but you try. And in a way, the development of the cathedral site itself, whereas the roof had to be renewed by the people, then the city and the university worked together to develop the whole surrounding. So it is that site stands as a symbol of, here you have church, city and academia working together for all to be given an environment they can be proud of. The School of Design and Technology is deliberately designed so the students at their desks or where they work design look out on the cathedral. And they said, we want them to look onto a thing of beauty as they work. Now, that's cooperation. So I think we have a lot to be thankful for.
And perhaps to offer other cities around Europe, across the continent,
I think it probably depends on their story, their history. But, of course, there is also the fact that in Liverpool, so many people still are Catholics compared with other, let us say, cities in England. But, of course, some cities in Europe are massively more Catholic than we are. But the element of cooperation is a long tradition. It's not new.
My thanks there to Archbishop Patrick Kelly of Liverpool. July 9th, the world's newest nation of South Sudan was born as church bells rang out and people celebrated in the streets. After half a century of civil war, this separation from the Arab-dominated north of Sudan marks the culmination of a peace deal drawn up in 2005. During the conflict, often called Africa's Forgotten War, up to 1.5 million people lost their lives, while an estimated 4 million more were displaced from their homes. Yet amid the Independence Day celebrations, few are under any illusions about the huge challenges the new nation faces. South Sudan, in fact, ranks at the bottom of the UN's Quality of Life Index for the world's 193 countries. The illiteracy rate there stands at 85%. The vast majority of people live well below the poverty line, and one in every four children dies before the age of five. Though the country is rich in oil and other natural resources, it is chronically lacking in infrastructure and other basic services for people, especially in the Nuba Mountain region, where the oil is located and where conflict still continues.
In Nuba Mountains, is a very beautiful place to live in, but it is also the cause of the conflict.
Father Joseph Marius is a priest with the young Uganda-based congregation, the Apostles of Jesus. Originally from Juba in South Sudan, he's currently studying Arabic and Islamic studies here in Rome. But before that, he worked as a missionary in the Nuba Mountain region.
If the poor indigenous people of the Nubas suffering, undergoing all this fighting, it's just because of these resources, which maybe the ruling party might not allow to go to another hand, in a way. And this is the cause of the conflict, actually. And also, apart from that, the Nubas have their grievances, too. In a way, they have been marginalized also for so long, in terms of the basic necessities in human life. So because of this reason, they are not also happy. They would like the central government to see into their grievances. And it has been for a long time, so that's why the people rose up in rebellion.
What is the standard of living there? How difficult is life for people there today?
Up to this moment, of course, life there is difficult. Even people don't have water to drink at a certain time. And until the diocese of El Obeid in Nuba Mountains area, which was under Bishop Makram Max, even during the time of wars, difficulties, he was the one who started drilling bare holes for them. Then eventually the people are now at least having clean water to drink from these bare holes, which have been drilled within the time of war there. Then when the peace agreement was signed in 2005, and more NGOs also came in order to help to drill more bare holes. And this has changed at least the life of the Nuba people. But unfortunately, again, now they have gone to square one, and there is already war going on. I think also I am quite sure they are cut off from basic services. Like people are just in the state of war now.
You were working there in a parish. The church is very strong there, isn't it? Providing, in a sense, what the state is unable to provide.
Exactly. The church has been, in fact, closed with the people during the time of war because the movement was unable to provide the people with the basic necessity.
The movement, you mean the SPLA?
The SPLA. They were, of course, fighting in order to liberate the people. So they were unable to provide the people with the basic needs. And the church came to the aid of these people. And the church was able to help the Nuba people in terms of basic needs like clothing and soap and salt, which were not available during those years.
You had your own difficulties with the SPLA, didn't you?
My difficulties was not actually with the SPLA. My difficulties was with the Sudan Army Forces. Actually, that's when I was still in the school in Juba, when they changed the education policy in 1991, and the students demonstrated, actually. This led to the close of schools and all this in Juba. And many students decided to move away, and they went on foot to the neighboring countries in order to pursue education. And of course, in course of this, many of them also lost their life because walking all the way from South Sudan to neighboring countries, it was not easy. Many of them died because of hunger, lack of water on the way. And also many of them who practically enter maybe in the ambush of the army, and they got killed. And I was among those who try also. So I got arrested with some group.
You were leaving Juba and heading to
Uganda.
To Uganda.
Yeah, walking. But unfortunately, we landed in the hands of the army, and they arrested us, and then many of us were in prison for 2 or 3 months, then eventually released and asked not to go out of Sudan again. And that was the difficulties I encountered. It was tough for me that moment because I had to stay in prison. And then eventually I was asked not to move anywhere.
So you went back to Juba?
In fact, we were even in prison in Juba because we were brought from where they arrested us. Then they brought us back to Juba. And then that's where we were in prison. We were released in Juba. And we were asked to remain in Juba.
What were conditions like there in the jail?
The condition was terrible. It was not easy. We were packed in a small room where over 30 people, just a small room. You sit and you don't sleep. Rather, you have nowhere to lay your head, actually. And it was very tough for us. Once you sit, you sit. And once you stand, you stand. Because the room was so packed. And we lived there for so many days.
How did that affect you as you look back at your experience now and you look forward to this new nation there in South Sudan? How does that affect your views of the North, for example?
In fact, I'm very happy to see that the South becomes an independent country because even we always say, if somebody is close to you and he knows you and he is like your brother and sister, this person always, in your suffering, he is always able to pity you. But the North and the South, we claim to be brothers and sisters. I mean, many a time, because the country also is so vast, we see each other as brothers and sisters so long as we share the resources. But when it comes to maybe difficulties, say this person is said to be wrong, then this sense of brotherhood always goes away. This one see the other one as not my brother, is an enemy. So he or she doesn't care of the suffering of the other one. So, and because of this, I would say the South should go and try by itself as a country. I think in the South, people have many ethnic groups, but they are closely linked. They also intermarried, and they are closely linked. Then if this kind of suffering which I encounter, if I was to be in the hands of the Southerners, I think they would have more pity on me than our brothers in the North.
You're studying Arabic, Islamic studies.
Yes.
Do you see yourself or the church as a whole as an important factor in trying to understand, to make peace, to reconcile after so many years of war and conflict?
Yes, for sure. I'm like a figure who would be like a bridge between the two. But I would say this, you know, this has been like so many years of struggle and maybe hatred and all sort of thing. It is always good if now the two cannot understand each other, it is better to part. But not to say, okay, I have to go and make my own home. I don't want you to come to this home. No. I think I would say it's good that the two should separate. But they should remain as brothers and sisters because they share the common border. And they have a lot to share in terms of even human resources, in terms of other resources too. And for me, this is very important because you, in this world, you cannot live in isolation.
So it's important to strengthen cooperation between the North and the New South.
Yes. Even in terms of economic wise, these two countries need really to work together.
My thanks there to Father Joseph Marius from the newly independent South Sudan. And that's all from me, Philippa Hitchin, and from all of us here at the English Programme for today. Don't forget you can find all our news and feature programmes on the internet. Look us up at www.vaticanradio.org/English. Thanks for listening, and do be sure to join us again at this same time tomorrow if you can. You're listening to Vatican Radio. Laudato Jesus Christus.